The Right Question is supported in part by Humanities Montana, bringing Montanans together to learn and reflect for 40 years, and by listeners like you.
Why is Lola Wicks in Wyoming?
Lola has been furloughed from her job in Montana. She works for a small newspaper up on the Rocky Mountain front. And what's happened to her has happened to newspaper reporters around the country as papers try to save money. They say, hey, take a vacation. We're not going to pay you, but you'll have a job when you get back. And that has happened to her. This doesn't make her happy. She doesn't particularly like vacation, but she really doesn't have a choice. And so in order to get out of town, not do any work, because if you work on furlough, you get fired, she takes her daughter and goes down to Yellowstone.
Hello, and welcome to The Right Question, a program that features authors from the Western U.S. I'm Cherie Newman, talking with Gwen Florio about Disgraced, which is the third novel in her Lola Wicks series. Although reading Disgraced doesn't require you to have read the other two books, Montana and Dakota, let's hear a little bit about what was going on in Lola's life before this story begins.
Lola was, before the first book, actually, she was a foreign correspondent in Afghanistan and was downsized from that job rather than go back to her paper in Baltimore, where a really fun job in the suburbs awaited her. She went off to visit a friend in Montana. When she got there, that friend had been murdered, which led to a series of events that sort of sucked her into living in Montana. She ended up forming a romantic attachment with the sheriff who investigated that murder. That sort of played out in the second book. And now here she is in book three, really kind of firmly entwined with beyond just the sheriff as a romantic partner. Now she has a daughter.
Right. She and Charlie have a five-year-old daughter who's mm-hmm. traveling with Lola on this trip to Wyoming during this furlough vacation. And it becomes clear right away in chapter one that this is a very dangerous situation in which to have a child along. And let's just hear a few paragraphs from chapter one.
Okay. The shout could have been one of happiness, the pop, coming as it did amid a teary jubilation of the military homecoming ceremony in Casper, Wyoming, anything at all. A teenage daughter cracking her gum in excitement, a burst balloon among one of the dozens of celebratory bunches, a compression of bubble wrap from a torn open welcome home gift. Reporter Lola Wicks knew better. She shoved her five-year-old daughter Margaret to the hangar's concrete floor and fell atop her, reaching simultaneously for her phone to tap a quick tweet as Margaret's body shuddered beneath her. Shot fired. Casper Airport. Soldiers homecoming. The returning soldiers knew too, scuttling toward the sound in a battle crouch, reaching for the weapons they no longer carried. Lola rolled off Margaret and shouted to the strange young woman she'd just met, "Take her! Get her out of here! Go now!" She waited the second it took to ensure the woman indeed headed with Margaret toward the hangar's entrance, then turned and followed the sprinting soldiers in the other direction. Above them, balloon bouquets flew in brilliant starbursts toward the hangar's domed ceiling. Lola raised her phone as she ran, snapping photos of the fleeing civilians, images that in her experience would look just like every other photo of people making the split-second transition from normalcy to a flight for their lives, whether from earthquake or school shooting or suicide bombing. Arms pumped for greater speed, faces twisted in screams, eyes rolled wild, not yet glazed against the reality that would hit home too soon. Lola stopped to tweet a photo, then headed for the far corner of the hangar where the soldiers converged. She shouldered her way through the cluster of fatigues, thinking not for the first time that soldiers were far more polite and moving aside than elbow-throwing television cameramen, several of whom over the years had left her with bruises, one once lobbing an actual punch. Lola reached the inner circle and wished she hadn't. She worked the phone yet again. Soldier town. Shot appears fatal, possibly self-inflicted. Hashtag Casper shooting. She concentrated on the words, the needs to inform without jumping to conclusions, the necessity of the ass-saving appears and possibly, even though there was no appears about it, no way for 140 characters to convey the mess that had once been the soldier's head. Soon enough, crime scene technicians would note the powder burns on what was left of the skin of his face, would verify that the gun was his own, that the bullet that had killed him had been fired from the pistol cooling in the hand, already going gray, would write a lengthy report that would supply all the details that Lola and the cursing veterans around her could see with their own eyes. Lola's phone buzzed with a text alert. She edged her way back through the circle. The text was from Jan Carpenter, her friend and colleague at the newspaper in Magpie, Montana, more than 500 miles away. WTF, you're supposed to be on vacation. Not your state, not your story. Walk away. Is Margaret okay? What about my cousin? Crap. Lola ran through the now deserted hangar, dodging the duffel bags and purses that people had abandoned in their haste to escape. The crowd outside surged toward her, shouting questions. She ignored them, calling for her daughter. Margaret? Margaret? And oh heck, what was the name of Jan's peculiar cousin, the woman who'd hustled Margaret to safety? Something as odd as the woman herself. Palomino? Pal? Pal Jones? Hey. A voice like a hard swipe of sandpaper, unexpectedly close at hand. Lola snatched Margaret from the woman's arms. Oh, baby. She pressed her cheek to Margaret's, inhaling her weedy scent. Boom, Mommy. Margaret patted Lola's face with soft hands. Lola lifted her head and scrutinized her daughter. Margaret had her father's lustrous ebony hair, bound this day in braids, stick straight in contrast to Lola's chestnut tangle. Margaret had Charlie's skin, too, albeit a lighter shade of brown, but her eyes were Lola's own, gray and skeptical, and for the moment wide with a question. So she didn't know what had happened, only the sound. Lola let her breath out. Yes, she said, boom, a big noise, nothing to worry about. We should get going now. We're just in the way here. That last said with obvious reluctance, a nod to the fact that on most days it was Lola's role to be the hot center of whatever was happening.
When I read the part about her falling on top of her daughter and tweeting at the same time, that was just a huge statement about the conflict that she feels. She loves her daughter, but wow, her first instinct was to send out a tweet.
Right, and it is so ingrained in you. As something's happening, you want to be first with it. You want to be telling people what's happened. And your hands are just working that phone, even if, you know, in this case, you've got a five-year-old with you. And Lola being Lola would rationalize, well, I'm on top of her. I'm protecting her. So tweet away.
Charlie certainly doesn't feel the same way.
No, Charlie's a really responsible parent.
They have several phone conversations during this story in which it becomes very apparent that he's worried about the situation, but he doesn't even know that Lola is following up on the story.
Right. She goes ahead. What's happened with this soldier is so striking to her, and what she learned subsequently about other soldiers who served over there with this group from the same small town in Wyoming makes her think that here's a really obvious story about the way war comes home with people. And she determines to pursue that story possibly as a freelance article, since, again, she can't write for her own paper. But in her mind, this is so much better than being on vacation.
Most people would be in Yellowstone going wahoo over the bison or...
It's a concept.
Well, as you said, there was a group of soldiers that all went over to Afghanistan together. They all graduated from high school in the same area. And joined up after a night of partying. There was one young man named Mike St. Clair who was different from the other five members of the group. Tell us about him.
Yeah, Mike was Shoshone. The fictional town in this book lies on the border of the very real Wind River Reservation, which holds the Shoshone and Arapaho tribes. He did not go to the town high school. He went to the reservation school. But he and Pal had grown up together and were friends. Their fathers ranched together. And so he went with them. Throughout high school, he'd kind of been accepted as Pal's buddy. Once they got to Afghanistan, and under the strains there, some stresses started to show in those relationships.
And his character allowed you to really bring out the real life problems that exist between people on the reservation and those who live in the outlying towns.
Yeah, and those were things I heard back when I was a reporter. I had done some stories on the reservation, and I was struck by some of the comments people off reservation made to me. For instance, I was writing about their basketball team. They have a really fabulous both boys and girls basketball teams. And I was going to go to a game, obviously, if you're writing a story. And a couple of times in town, people said, well, you're not going there at night. Yeah, I am. And that just, again, kind of struck me that even today, you had heard stories about a few decades back, there'd be signs on businesses in town saying no Indians allowed. I thought those days were long behind, and not so much.
Your real life experience as a reporter in Wyoming then was what you based some of this story on.
It was, and partly doing this book was pretty selfish. I really love that area. It's quite beautiful there, so it gave me a reason to go back there and explore some of the things in more depth that you can get into in a newspaper story.
How long ago was it when you were working there?
Oh, gosh, 10 and 20 years ago for various papers.
Yeah, but still not all that long ago.
Right. And in reading stories now about some of the things going on there, a lot of that is still pretty front and center.
Hmm. Well, during her search for information, Lola went to see the high school principal, Arlie Colton. So let's just hear a little bit about that encounter.
Right. This is in the summertime, obviously, vacation, Yellowstone. But the school, as schools often are, was still open. People were getting some work done. And she went to find the principal to say, what happened over there? You knew all of these kids. What made things fall apart the way they appear to have done? And the chapter opens with the principal speaking. It's because of Miss Jones. Arlie Colton, 30 High School's principal, delivered the answer to Lola's question about Mike St. Clair with visible distaste, immediately laying waste to her plan not to bring up Pal's name. She went to school with the others, he said. He ticked them off on his fingers, Mr. Lowry, Mr. Dillon, Mr. McSpadden, Mr. Graff. But she grew up with Mike, and so she always dragged him into our activities. No corresponding Mr. for Mike, Lola noticed. I don't understand, she said. Miss Jones' family, I suppose her parents, grandparents, or however many generations back it happened, bought up fee lands. The light clicked on for Lola. A few years ago, the word would have meant nothing to her. But living with Charlie and in such proximity to the Blackfeet Nation, she'd learned that reservations were hardly all Indian bastions. During the starvation years after the reservations were formed, and with the help from a federal abomination known as the Dawes Act that further wrested land from tribes by force of law rather than war, white people snapped up prime reservation land, fee lands, sold for a pittance by desperate tribes. A century later, many tribes were trying to buy that land back, parcel by newly high-priced parcel. Lola remembered Pal telling her that Delbert lived on the reservation, Delbert being Mike St. Clair's grandfather. Funny, Lola thought, that Pal neglected to mention that her land, too, was on the res. Arlie Colton was still talking. Their parents were neighbors, such parents as Mike had. His grandfather, mostly. His father, you know, was killed in the Gulf War. And his mother, he tipped his hand in front of his mouth, indicating drink. He lost her, too. Miss Jones went to the schools in town and Mike to the Indian school. That way, he got to play for the Chiefs. The Chiefs? You're not from Wyoming, are you? Everybody in the state knows about the Chiefs and the Lady Chiefs, too. They make it to the basketball finals just about every year and to the championship a fair amount of the time, too. Pity that's as far as most of them go. Lola had heard the queasy-making soliloquy about Indian athletes, great in high school but a tendency to fall apart in colleges far from their families, too many times in Montana to want to hear the Wyoming version. She tried to steer Arlie Colton back on track. But he attended a lot of your school's activities? Miss Jones included him wherever she could at events in our school, though why he wanted to come was beyond me. It can't have been comfortable for him, but she insisted. They were friends. Closer than most. The curl of his lip and flare of nostril indicated disapproval. There was talk. What sort of talk? As if Lola couldn't guess. A white girl, an Indian boy? Lola had grown up on Maryland's eastern shore, hearing the same sort of talk about white girls who had the temerity to say more than two words to black classmates.
So that pretty much describes the setup for what happens in Afghanistan, which we won't go too far into because then it would be a mystery. You're listening to The Right Question. I'm Cherie Newman. Gwen Florio is here with me, and we're talking about her latest mystery novel, Disgraced. If you'd like to listen again or share this program with a friend, it's available as a podcast and at our blog. Links to both are at mtpr.org/twq. There's also a link to it on our Facebook and Twitter pages. When we come back, Gwen Florio will tell us how she uses humor to break up the tension in her crime novels, and we'll find out what's coming in novels 4 and 5. Don't go away. What's the significance of the name of the town?
30. That was me having fun with journalism. I made up this town that allegedly was founded by a newspaper man whose wagon foundered on the banks of the river. His heavy printing press made it break down, and they said, the heck with it, this is as far as we go. 30 is the number that reporters used to type at the end of their stories back in the days of typewriters to signify when they handed off the story to the guys who would run it down to the printing press that the story was over. And I don't know that anyone knows why 30-30- became the symbol. So 30 was the end of the line.
Something else you had fun with was a chicken.
I had a lot of fun with the chicken. The problem, at least for me, with writing mysteries is that they are necessarily grim. You know, people die, and especially in this book with war involved, people die in really horrible ways, and you've got to inject some humor. And I think in every book I've used animals to provide the humor, and in this one it's a chicken. My sister has chickens. I grew up with chickens. I like them, but, you know, they're chickens. They're kind of stupid and mean.
Well, this one had it out for Lola's feet.
He really did, and I love that about him. Whenever she walked around barefoot, he'd come running at her and peck at her feet just viciously. And so she never knew, you know, he was always hiding someplace and would dash out and attack her.
But her daughter, Margaret, had a great relationship with this chicken.
Right, which made it even more fun. It was just one more way the daughter could sort of needle the mother a little bit. You know, he's fine with me, Mommy.
You made Lola a terrible cook, which is also another way to, I guess, break up the tension. Was that part of your strategy?
Again, it was part of it. I would describe myself as an unenthusiastic cook. I'm better than that, thank God. But it was fun to sort of take my own natural tendency and really embroider upon it and make her just dreadful.
She was awful. She couldn't even cook a hamburger.
I know. Or rice or any of the basics.
Lola's significant other, Charlie, did all the cooking when she was at home.
Yeah, not only did he do the cooking, but he really insisted upon nutritious food, not just for himself, but for Margaret. And that's not only because Charlie is just a good guy and a good cook, but poor nutrition is such an issue on reservations. First of all, it's hard to get healthy food there, expensive to get healthy food, and he was really going to make sure his daughter did not grow up to face the same sort of issues with diabetes and poor dental care and stuff that seemed to plague a lot of reservations.
And another piece of the tension in this story is that he has asked Lola to marry him, and mm-hmm. she keeps putting him off.
Yeah, marriage was never going to be in her cards, so bad enough that she ended up living with this guy, and now she's a mom. It's really fun to throw things like that at Lola that go against her natural instincts to make her a mother. She's sort of forced to be nurturing, and she's sort of helping take care of Pal, who's one of the veterans who's returned, who is really in pretty bad shape. And the last thing Lola wants to do is take care of anybody. And now, you know, she has her daughter, she has Pal, she's got this chicken the neighbor comes over a lot. He'd like to eat once in a while, you know. So she's just beset by domesticity.
When you quit your full-time job as a reporter, I think it was in 2013.
It was.
You gave yourself 3 years to succeed as a fiction writer. And I think you're about 2.5 years into that.
I'm about there, May 31st. That date is engraved in memory.
And this is your third published book, and I understand that you just turned in the manuscript for your fourth and are working on the fifth.
I am.
So what does that gamble that you took look like now to you?
Oh, God, it feels wonderful and kind of unbelievable. I mean, I literally, before I left the job, probably spent 3 weeks lying awake at night just in absolute panic trying to make the decision. And I like to tell people, when you leap off the high dive, you know, and hit the water, you better swim. And I think that's the only thing that propelled me, was absolute panic. I had the contract for the second book, and the second book almost done when I quit. The gamble was going to be trying to find a larger publisher and getting more books published, which I did. I got a 3-book contract, and I'm working on the last of those 3 now, as you noted. And I think that's the closest you get to job security in this business. It's pretty wonderful.
Is having a 3-book contract, right?
Yeah, and then with luck, you get another one, or, you know, so on and so forth.
Is it everything you thought it would be?
Yeah, I don't know what I thought it would be. It feels a lot like a job now, especially when you've got a deadline looming over you. You can't kind of fool around. You've got to sit down and, I mean, I sat down and wrote every day anyway, but now you really have to. And I am stealing a line from Keith McCafferty, who's over in Bozeman and writes fly fishing mysteries. And advice he gave to me after my first book was a book a year and each book better than the one before. And I really try to do that. I try to look at where I felt like maybe I could have used some more work or deepened things in the previous book and try to do that in the next book and so on. So I'm always sort of setting the bar higher. I keep waiting for it to be easy, and I know that realistically it's never going to be easy, but it's really great. I really love doing it.
It's a different job.
Yeah.
I read a review online, I think it was on Goodreads.com this morning, where a woman said that she enjoyed Disgraced so much that now she was going to go back and read Montana and Dakota.
Oh, I love that.
So that is probably the goal here, since those first 2 books were published with a very small publisher.
Mm-hmm. I very deliberately have written each book so that it could stand on its own. There are enough references as to what happened before that you do have that background, but you know, you can pick it up in the middle of the series, if 3 books is a series at this point, and not be lost.
What made you want to change from writing nonfiction to writing fiction?
Oh, gosh, I'd always wanted to do that. It was just a matter of me getting my skill level up to a point where it was actually publishable. I had been writing fiction, or trying to write fiction, I guess, for about 20 years before I got a book published. Had gotten some short stories published, but it is just hard, at least for me. It's really hard. And trying to do it the way everybody tries to do it, which is at nights or on weekends. Some people do it early in the morning. I wasn't one of those people, but you try and fit it in around everything else. So it took even longer than it might have otherwise. But I'm really glad to have figured it out to the extent that I have.
I'm just always amazed when I talk to journalists who are writing books. They write all day.
Yeah.
And then they go home and write books at night.
Yeah. And I tell people, I think that's why I write these dark books. You know, I was so exhausted at the end of the day. I was just in a bad mood. And I'd sit down at my laptop and go, let's kill somebody now. I did not ever see myself writing a series. I was so happy to get the one book published. And then the second one really seemed like sort of a natural follow, where I sent Lola off to the oil patch as a reporter in this part of the world. That's something you naturally do. And at the time, my then publisher was thinking in terms of state names for all the books. So I had already written this book and sent proposals for 2 others that had her moving around doing freelance work. So I had to come up with that. And with a series, or at least I feel that way, your character really has to grow and change, so that's a challenge. I'm much more interested in character-driven books than plot-driven books. I don't want to name books, but something like The Da Vinci Code, you know, super successful, but super plot. Whereas I'm much more interested in books that delve more deeply into character. So Lola's character couldn't just be that one note, kind of Lola stomping around being pretty driven, even though she does that. And I thought the way to really, really complicate her life was to give her a child and make her face all these challenges that she's beginning to come up against in this book.
I think she is a much different person than she was when she got off the plane in Montana the first time. I mean, she had no clue how to navigate a small town, for instance.
Right.
And now in this book, three books in, she's pretty savvy. She can go in and ask questions without offending people.
Right. She's learned that. And what I'm doing in the fifth book is I'm sending her off to a city, and after many years in small towns, cities are now strange places to her. And again, that's sort of fun, you know, just things like her being late to a court appearance and not realizing that she's not going to find a parking space right outside the courthouse. She's going to have to find a parking garage and pay and then run three blocks and maybe make it to the courtroom in time.
What's going on in your fourth book that you just turned in?
In this one, Lola and Charlie go down to the Navajo reservation where his brother lives, and I think that's referred to in Disgraced. He married a Navajo woman and is down there, and they've never met Lola. So this is sort of the big thing. We're going to meld the families, and again, Lola is, more interpersonal relations, you know, not her strong point. And also, one thing that's happened is she's still a little rattled by everything that happened to her in Disgraced. And as you mentioned, it took her a long time to acclimate to the small town where she lives. Well, now that's her comfort zone, and she has to leave it and go to a strange place. And she's really kind of shaken up by that, not happy to leave Montana, which is not something you would have ever predicted of her early on.
No. Well, it'll be really interesting to see how she goes to a family reunion type situation and solves a mystery.
Right.
It sounds like another book where she's supposed to be off the job, but finds some way to write a story.
Always. Yeah. Always. And I think that's the, certainly it's the reporter in me or in any reporter. No matter what you do, you still see stories. To this day, I'll hear something and I'll think, God, that's a great story. You know, it's almost hard not to be reporting in this crazy election year because you couldn't make this stuff up. I mean, these stories are just like fish in a barrel. So, but I'll make Lola do them instead.
Gwen Florio lives in Missoula, Montana. Look for more information about her at our blog, mtpr.org/TWQ. You'll also find poems and children's book reviews there, as well as links to our Facebook and Twitter pages. The music in this program was written and performed by John Floridas and Tommy Emmanuel. Thanks a lot for listening. I'm Cherie Newman, wishing you a pile of fascinating books and lots of questions.
The Right Question is produced by Cherie Newman, Beth Ann Austin, studio engineer. You'll find links to our podcast and Facebook and Twitter pages at mtpr.org.